as resources diminish. As the income inequality gap widens, these trends are just going to get worse. Dawson, yeah. They had the largest corporate bailout in history, and no one went to jail. There were some protests, but then it faded away. And that was after a $16 trillion bailout of these financial institutions, plus the Federal Reserve jumping in after that with even more money. Valentine, that is the perfect example of why we do not live in a democracy. At the time, they did some polls, and 90% of the American public did not want the government to bail out the banks. These were decisions made by our secret rulers. All the big decisions in our democracy are made by them. Dawson. And mass media agreed with it. Too big to fail. Valentine. Yeah, that's a catchy slogan. And there are fewer rulers all the time, and more of us schleppers on the outside who are paying their bills. Dawson. Well, get out your pitchforks, people. Chapter 10. War Crimes as Policy. Co-authored with Nicholas J. S. Davies. In February 2013, The Guardian and BBC Arabic unveiled a documentary film exploring the role of retired Colonel James Steele in the recruitment, training, and initial deployments of the CIA-advised and funded Special Police Commandos in Iraq. The documentary was a departure from mainstream reporting in that it told how the commandos tortured and murdered tens of thousands of Iraqi men and boys. But the commandos are only one of America's many weapons of human destruction in Iraq. Along with U.S. military forces that murder indiscriminately, CIA-funded death squads that murdered selectively, and the CIA's Palace Guard, the Iraqi Special Operations Forces, the commandos are part of a genocidal campaign that had killed about 10% of the Sunni Arabs of Iraq by 2008 and driven half of all Sunnis from their homes. Including economic sanctions and a 50-year history of sabotage and subversion, America and its Iraqi collaborators have visited far more death and destruction on Iraq than Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athist regime. Driven into fanaticism by the brutal invasion and occupation, many thousands of Sunnis then formed the Islamic State of Iraq, ISI. After being decimated by U.S. forces, ISI was reinforced by former Ba'athist military and intelligence officers, as well as foreign mercenaries from places like Chechnya. Now known as ISIS, the militant Sunni resistance seized vast stretches of land in Iraq and Syria. Only as recently as June 2016 was it finally driven out of Fallujah. In the weeks after the documentary, American pundits began cataloging the horrors that had piled up by 2013. They told how the Bush and Obama regimes killed more than 1 million Iraqis, displaced around 5 million, and imprisoned and tortured hundreds of thousands without trial. The photos that were released of brutality at Abu Ghraib prison give but an inkling of the terror to which the Iraqis were subjected. The draconian administrative detention laws, systematic torture and executions that characterize the occupation are still in place in 2016. The Prime Minister's office, a position now held by Haidar Jawad Kadim al-Abad, is where the CIA-managed counterterrorism service is still ensconced. In May 2016, the CTS gained fame for leading the U.S. offensive to take back Fallujah from ISIS forces that had occupied the city since 2014. Iraqi soldiers and the National Police Forces assisted. The systematic oppression the Americans imposed upon Iraq meets the definition of genocide in the Genocide Convention and violates multiple articles of the Geneva Conventions guaranteeing protection to civilians in time of war. But the guilty Americans have gone unpunished for their war crimes, not least of which was falsifying intelligence about Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. British legal advisors repeatedly warned their government in 2003 that invading Iraq would be a crime of aggression, which they called one of the most serious offenses under international law. For anyone familiar with the CIA, the systematic oppression was predictable. But the U.S. government, as usual, destroyed and concealed most of the hard evidence of its war crimes, making it harder to prove. and the media is content to revise history and focus public attention on frontmen like Steele rather than the institutions, in particular the CIA, for whom they work. History, however, provides contextual evidence that what happened in Iraq amounts to an official but unstated policy of carefully planned war crimes. Indeed, the CIA modeled the Iraqi Special Police Commandos on the special police forces it organized and funded in Vietnam. In November 2000, Counterpunch published an article describing how former Congressman Rob Simmons, while serving as a CIA officer in Vietnam, created the Special Intelligence Force Unit, SIFU, on which the Iraqi Special Police Commandos are very likely modeled. There are other examples. As we were reminded by The Guardian, Steele headed the U.S. Military Advisory Group in El Salvador, 1984 to 1986, where U.S.-advised Salvadoran units were responsible for thousands of cases of torture and extrajudicial killing. Operating in both rural and urban areas, they were directed against anyone opposing U.S. policy. Always leftists advocating the things most hated by the CIA, land reform and redistribution of wealth from oligarchs to workers. The CIA's death squads in El Salvador were periodically moved from one administrative cover to another to confuse investigators. The CIA played this shell game with its special police commandos in Iraq as well, rebranding them as the National Police following the exposure of one of their secret torture centers in November 2005. In its finest Madison Avenue marketing traditions, the CIA renamed the commandos' predatory Wolf Brigade the Freedom Brigade, bringing to mind Reagan's description of the Contras as freedom fighters. In Vietnam, the CIA built an archipelago of secret torture centers to process the hundreds of thousands of suspects that were kidnapped by its mercenary army of counter-terrorists. All around the world, CIA officers and their military sidekicks teach modern torture techniques and design the torture centers concealed within the National Security Establishment's network of military posts. Along with the CIA's stations, those posts are the secret government's infrastructure for full-spectrum dominance. Major Joe Blair, the director of instruction at the School of the Americas, 1986 to 89, described the training the U.S. gave to Latin American officers as follows. The doctrine that was taught was that if you want information, you use physical abuse, false imprisonment, threats to family members, and killing. If you can't get the information you want, if you can't get that person to shut up or to stop what they're doing, you simply assassinate them, and you assassinate them with one of your death squads. In 2000, the School of the Americas was renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. But as Blair testified at a trial of SOA Watch protesters in 2002, there are no substantive changes besides the name. They teach the identical courses that I taught, and change the course names and use the same manuals. General Paul Gorman, who commanded U.S. forces in Central America in the mid-1980s, defined this type of warfare based on systematic war crimes as a form of warfare repugnant to Americans, a conflict which involves innocence, in which non-combatant casualties may be an explicit object. Another problem with the official narrative, apart from historical amnesia, is that each new war crime is viewed as an isolated incident, and when the dots are connected, the media's focus is always on some shadowy character like Steele. To its credit, The Guardian made a feeble attempt to connect Steele to the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, David Petraeus, and former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. But it ignored the overarching reality that the entire national security establishment is staffed by the same right-wing ideologues who power the U.S. government's unstated policy of waging systematic war crimes for profit. We know perfectly well who these militants are. The problem is that they regularly have lunch with the reporters whom the American public, in its naivete, trusts to expose them and their criminal conspiracy. For example, on 17 March 2013, CNN talking head Fareed Zakaria had Donald Gregg on his show to discuss North Korea. Zakaria introduced Gregg as President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor in the 1980s. but he did not mention that Gregg, while the senior CIA officer in 3 Corps in Vietnam, helped to develop the repugnant form of warfare described by General Gorman. Nor did Zakaria explain how Gregg oversaw its application in El Salvador through the CIA's back-channel counter-terror network. Gregg's plan, adopted by Steele in El Salvador and then Iraq, requires CIA advisors to coordinate the occupied nation's civilian security services, like the Iraqi Special Police, with military intelligence and civil affairs units, in order to provide reaction forces units with timely information on the location of guerrillas, whose hideouts are bombed by U.S. warplanes and then ravaged in My Lai-style cordon and search operations in which counter-terror death squads hunt enemy cadres in their homes. In Vietnam, Gregg and his CIA companions, many of whom migrated to El Salvador, put together a chart of VC political cadres from battered detainees. The abused detainees were forced to point out on a map where their comrades were hiding. Next, the CIA officers piled the detainees into a helicopter and had them point out the hiding places on the ground. A CT team would then snatch the targeted VC cadres and bring them to the CIA's secret torture center, run by a CIA-paid and owned special police officer, the kind of guy Steele advised in Iraq. "We brought guys in from the national prison to flesh out the reports," Gregg said about one particular operation. "We had guys analyzing reports, marking photographs, putting the pictures together on the wall, and then photographing that. That led to 96 people in the organization. Using military intelligence, we took photos of the houses where they lived. Then we took the photos back to the helicopter where we had the 23 people who were hooded, and they circled the faces of the cadres." There's more historical evidence of CIA tactics, but the Pink Plan, developed by CIA officers Gregg, Rudy Enders, and Felix Rodriguez in Vietnam, is the same basic plan the CIA exported to El Salvador and that Steele applied in Iraq. After finishing with Gregg, Zakaria took a commercial break and returned with Paul Wolfowitz, President George W. Bush's Deputy Secretary of Defense and a member of the Bush's Office of Special Plans, which planned and promoted the terror war on Iraq. "Zakaria, how do you think about, as an American policymaker, the issue of, was it worth the price in American lives and treasure, by some estimates, $1 trillion? Wolfowitz: "I would like as much as anyone to be able to say, let's forget about the Persian Gulf. Let's forget about the larger Middle East. But that part of the world isn't leaving us alone. Al-Qaeda isn't leaving us alone. Pakistan isn't leaving us alone. I think our interests and our values would be advanced if we stick with it." Zakaria did not ask Wolfowitz what he meant by leaving us alone. War criminals waive press passes. Given the history of America's genocidal wars in Vietnam and Central America, it is unfortunate that The Guardian limited itself to establishing that Steele and his administrative bosses, General David Petraeus and Donald Rumsfeld, underwrote systematic torture and extrajudicial killing. What needs to be stressed is that thousands of Americans, including unelected political cadres like Wolfowitz, and scores of journalists with access to them like Zakaria, know that the CIA-owned Ministry of Interior operates more than a dozen secret prisons. They know what goes on in them, too. As one Iraqi general told the filmmakers, "Drilling, murder, torture, the ugliest sorts of torture I've ever seen." Likewise, the composition and operations of special police death squads, an American interviewee said, were discussed openly, wherever it was, at staff meetings, and were common knowledge across Baghdad. Common knowledge never shared with the public. It is a testament to the power of U.S. information warfare that this policy of systematic war crimes comes as a surprise to the general public. Such is the power of national security state insiders like David Korn and Michael Isikoff, who happily turn a policy of calculated war crimes into the hubris of a few sexy mad patriots whom the establishment is glad to scandalize but never prosecute. Certainly people have to be reminded, and the young have to learn, that America's policy of war crimes for profit cannot exist without the complicity of the mainstream media, which shamelessly exploits our inclination to believe that our leaders behave morally. As George Orwell wrote in 1945, the nationalist not only does not disapprove of atrocities committed by his own side, but he has a remarkable capacity for not even hearing about them. Belligerent nationalism is understood in America as the essence of patriotism, and this veneration for militants is taught to all budding reporters at journalism schools, along with the sacred code of silence. Which is why, when insider Seymour Hersh reported that the CIA and Israel were training special forces assassination squads for deployment in Iraq based on the Phoenix program model, he described it in a bloodless manner that made it seem necessary and, at worst, a mistake. But war crimes are not a mistake. They are a repugnant and thoroughly intentional form of modern American warfare. Hersh quoted a former CIA station chief as saying, "We have to resuscitate Iraqi intelligence, holding our nose, and have Delta and agency shooters break down doors and take them, the insurgents, out." Hold your nose, Seymour, and cheer the war crimes. When insider Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! Interviewed Hersh about the Phoenix-style murder program, she didn't ask if it amounted to a policy of war crimes. When insider Zakaria had Wolfowitz on the hot seat, he failed to question him about the war crimes he plotted and committed. All this media psywar is waged in the name of maintaining morale, to make us feel good about our leaders, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Frum, and Faith, and the war crimes they commit in our name. After the CIA death squads eliminated the senior leadership of the Iraqi government in 2003, they targeted mid-level Ba'ath Party members, a large portion of Iraq's middle class. Cover for this needless rampage was provided by Newsweek's top national security propagandist, John Barry, who quoted an army officer as saying, "The Sunni population is paying no price for the support it is giving to the terrorists. From their point of view, it is cost-free. We have to change that equation." How did they change the equation? In one case, U.S. forces held the general's three sons as hostages to persuade him to defect. But instead of releasing his sons as promised, they staged an elaborate mock execution of his youngest son before torturing the general himself to death. All of it is covered up. Not one victim featured on TV. All you'll ever see is ISIS beheading people. If you were to believe the New York Times, America's newspaper of record, it doesn't know the names of the CIA officers in Iraq behind these barbaric practices. Publishers may claim that the Intelligence Identity Protection Act prevents them from naming names, but they could describe the jobs and tell us what's being done. But they don't even do that. And that self-censorship is what the policy of war crimes depends upon. The Times conceals the criminal conspiracy waged by militant elites that undermines our democracy. We will never learn the truth about how the CIA nurtured the exile leadership it installed in Iraq, or how it organized the Ministry of Interior as its private domain, replete with a computerized list of every Iraqi citizen and every detail of their lives. The Times could at least describe the CIA as keeper of the hit lists, blackmail central. But it won't, because it's a family affair. As we know, the Iraqi National Congress was headed by Ahmed Shalabi, the CIA-sponsored source on the myth of weapons of mass destruction, hand-delivered to Times reporter Judy Miller, now a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a Fox News analyst. Shalabi's lies and Miller's dutiful reporting of them were a major pretext for the war on Iraq. What is never mentioned is that the Iraqi National Congress was founded and funded by the CIA, and that one of its leaders was the exiled General Hassan al-Naqib. The CIA handpicked al-Naqib's son, Falah al-Naqib, as interim interior minister in Iraq, and in return for the favor, Falah appointed his uncle, General Tawhit, to lead the special police commandos. Times reporters undoubtedly lunch with Tawhit and his CIA case officer, which may be why they never explained the CIA's systematic methods of dominance. For example, that any American working for the Interior Ministry or Prime Minister's office is reporting to a publicly acknowledged administrative boss in the military or State Department, while secretly reporting to a CIA case officer, his operational boss. The Times never explains that every unit in the Special Commandos has a CIA advisor handing out hit lists to its counterpart American Special Police Transition Team. Up to 45 U.S. Special Forces soldiers work with each Iraqi unit. These teams are in round-the-clock communication with their CIA bosses via the Special Police Command Center. There is no record of the Special Police or Special Commandos ever conducting operations without U.S. supervision, even as they massacred tens of thousands of people. Every militia and Iraqi Special Forces unit has a CIA case officer in a similar management position. Every top Iraqi politician and ministry official has a CIA case officer, too. And New York Times reporters drink with these advisors inside the Green Zone. It's the family secret that enables atrocity. American journalists do not report the truth. Consider their deference to the Interior Ministry's CIA advisor, Stephen Castile, after his Special Police Commandos launched their reign of terror in Baghdad. All reports of a Phoenix-style terror campaign were conveniently forgotten, and instead, Knight Ridder reporters regurgitated Castile's black propaganda that all atrocities were either rumor or innuendo or perpetrated by insurgents in stolen police uniforms. Forget about mistakes. Castile's explanation is as ludicrous as General Petraeus claiming that the Iraqis formed the Special Police Commandos on their own initiative. In its profile, Knight Ridder did not mention that Castile had managed DEA operations in Latin America. It did not say that he'd been the DEA's chief of intelligence before being sent to Iraq, or that the CIA has controlled the DEA's overseas targeting for 40 years. It wasn't noted that Castile served as a CIA asset in Latin America, attacking left-wing drug traffickers and letting right-wing traffickers flourish, supporting the CIA-sponsored Los Pepes AUC death squads who were responsible for about 75% of civilian deaths in the Colombian Civil War over the next 10 years. Knight Ridder did investigate commando atrocities and might have uncovered the whole story, but its Iraqi reporter, Yasser Salehi, was shot and killed by an American sniper in June 2005. Heeding what was an unmistakable warning, Knight Ridder instead blamed the abuses on infiltration of the commandos by Shiite militias. After the exposure of the Al-Jadiriya torture center, journalists reported that heads would roll. But CIA asset Adnan al-Assadi, the deputy interior minister, maintained command of the national police and prevented reforms promised by the interior minister at the time, Jawad al-Bulani. Throughout his CIA-sponsored tenure, Assadi's police forces were implicated in human rights abuses. During demonstrations in Tahrir Square in Baghdad in March 2011, demonstrators spotted Assadi on a rooftop directing snipers as they shot peaceful protesters in the square below. But no war crime goes unrewarded, and Assadi was eventually elected to parliament, where the big money is to be made. Such are the advantages of working for the CIA. Today, Iraq's prisons are still rife with rape, torture, executions, and disappearances. The Guardian and the BBC made a good start, but U.S. journalists need to launch an investigation into the full extent of U.S. command and control of the Special Police Commandos and all the death squads and torture centers the U.S. imposed on Iraq. Such an investigation must honestly examine the roles of the CIA and of U.S. Special Forces, including the secret Night Stalkers, who worked with the Wolf Brigade in 2005. The investigation must lead to accountability for every war crime committed, all the way to the top. American journalists were glad to demonize Saddam Hussein for his war crimes, real and imagined. Now they need to identify and humanize the dead bodies that piled up every month in Baghdad. they need to follow up with Iraqi human rights groups like the Organization for Follow-Up and Monitoring, which matched 92% of the bodies of execution victims with names and descriptions of people detained by U.S.-led Interior Ministry forces. America's ruling national security establishment has expanded covert paramilitary operations from 60 nations in 2008 to 120 in 2013. If we are ever to have a whiff of democracy, we need our journalists to reveal the extent to which the CIA commands and controls these operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria. We need them to explain on a daily basis how the national security establishment corrupts foreign nations, intelligence, and news for the same racist imperial purposes that have defined U.S. foreign policy since its inception 240 years ago. Chapter 11. New Games, Same Aims. CIA Organizational Changes. Guillermo Jimenez. Welcome to Demanufacturing Consent. I am your host, Guillermo Jimenez. Our guest today is Douglas Valentine. How are you today? Valentine. I'm well. Thanks for having me on the show. Jimenez. The Phoenix program has recently been republished by Open Road Media as part of their Forbidden Bookshelves series. Would you mind sharing with us how your book was chosen for the series? What do you make of this newfound interest in Phoenix? What the CIA was up to in Vietnam, and what the CIA is up to generally? Valentine. When the book came out in 1990, it got a terrible review in the New York Times. Morley Safer, who'd been a reporter in Vietnam, wrote the review. Safer and the Times killed the book because in it I said Phoenix never would have succeeded if the reporters in Vietnam hadn't covered for the CIA. Several senior CIA officers said the same thing, that so-and-so was always in my office, he'd bring a bottle of scotch, and I'd tell him what was going on. The celebrity reporters knew what was going on, but they didn't report about it in exchange for having access. I said that in the book specifically about the New York Times. So I not only got the CIA angry at me, I also got the Vietnam Press Corps angry at me, too. Between those two things, the book did not get off to an auspicious start. The Times gave Safer half a page to write his review, which was bizarre. The usual response is just to ignore a book like the Phoenix Program. But the New York Times book review serves a larger function. It teaches the media elite and intelligentsia what to think and how to say it. So Safer said my book was incoherent because it unraveled the bureaucratic networks that concealed the contradictions between policy and operational reality. It exposed Colby as a liar. Safer was upset that I didn't portray his friend and patron Bill Colby as a symbol of the elite, as a modern-day Odysseus. Luckily, with the Internet revolution, people aren't bound by the Times and network news anymore. They can listen to Russia Today and get another side of the story. So Mark Crispin Miller and Philip Rappaport at Open Road chose the Phoenix program to be the first book they published. And it's been reborn. Thanks to the advent of the e-book, we've reached an audience of concerned and knowledgeable people in a way that wasn't possible 25 years ago. It's also because of these internet developments that John Brennan, the director of CIA, thought of reorganizing the CIA. All these things are connected. It's a vastly different world than it was in 1947 when the CIA was created. The nature of the American empire has changed, and what the empire needs from the CIA has changed. The CIA is allocated about $30 billion a year, so the organizational changes are massive undertakings. If you want to understand the CIA, you have to understand how it's organized. Jimenez. Exactly. And that's what I want to talk to you about next. But first, I'd like to touch upon the CIA's infiltration of the U.S. media. I find it curious, because the way that you describe it, it's not so much a deliberate attempt to censor the media. There's a lot of self-censorship as a result of that already existing relationship. Is that how you see this? Valentine, yes. The media organizes itself the way the CIA does. The CIA has case officers running around the world, engaged in murder and mayhem, and the media has reporters covering them. The reporter and the case officer both have bosses, and the higher you get in each organization, the closer the bosses become. The ideological guidelines get more restrictive the higher up you go. To join the CIA, you have to pass a psychological assessment test. They're not going to hire anybody who is sympathetic towards poor people. These are ruthless people who serve capitalist bosses. They're very right-wing, and the media's job is to protect them. Editors only hire reporters who are ideologically pure, just like you can't get into the CIA if you're a communist or think the CIA should obey the law. It's the same thing in the media. You can't get a job at CNN if you sympathize with the Palestinians or report how Israel has been stealing their land for 67 years. The minute you say something that is an anathema or upsets the Israelis, you're out. The people who enforce these ideological restraints are the editors and the publishers. For example, while covering the merciless Israeli bombardment of civilians in Gaza in 2014, Diana Magne was harassed and threatened by a group of bloodthirsty Israelis who were cheering the slaughter. Disgusted, Magne later referred to them as scum in a tweet. She was forced to apologize, transferred to Moscow, and banished forever from Israel. In a similar case, NBC correspondent Ayman Moyeldin was playing soccer with four young boys in Gaza when Israel shelled the playing field. Moyeldin witnessed their murders, which he reported in a series of tweets. Without ever providing a reason, NBC pulled Moyeldin from Gaza and prevented him from ever returning. NBC replaced Moyeldin with Israeli sympathizer Richard Engel. Any dictator would be happy with the way American media is organized. The minute you step out of the box, they fire you or send you off to Siberia. It's a homogeneous system. Not just the media and the CIA, but politicians too. As the 2016 primaries proved, you can't be a candidate for either party unless you pass the ideological test. You must be a freewheeling capitalist. You must support Israel with billions of taxpayer dollars. You must give the military whatever weapons it wants. That's the nature of the American state. These things naturally work together because that is the way it has been structured for 240 years. Jimenez, we've seen pseudo-alternatives emerge in the Internet, posing as adversarial or anti-establishment when they're anything but. We've seen this growing trend, and it's something to be mindful of as we look for these sources on the Internet. Valentine, the Internet is a free-for-all, so you have to approach it the way any enlightened person approaches every part of America, which is buyer beware. Capitalism is not designed to protect poor people or make sure people lead healthy, fulfilling lives. It's designed to make sure the super rich can steal from the poor. There's only so much wealth, and the rich want it. The rich want to monopolize information, too. Is a particular piece of information on the Internet coming from a reliable source? Who knows? Just because some of it is true doesn't mean that all of it is true. To be able to discern whether the information is accurate or complete, you must be grounded in the reality that the capitalist system and all its facets are organized to oppress you, keep you in the dark and off balance as much as possible. It's a game of wits, and you've got to be smart about it. Buyer beware. Jimenez. Exactly. Now I'd like to talk about the recent organizational changes in the CIA. It stems from an article in the Washington Post by Greg Miller. The headline is CIA Director John Brennan Considering Sweeping Organizational Changes. What the article is saying is that Brennan wants to restructure the CIA using the model of their counterterrorism center, merging different units and divisions, combining analysts with operatives into hybrid teams that will focus on specific regions of the world. This sounds to me like the organizational changes that were born out of Phoenix and that were exported to other parts of the world over the years. The CIA appears to be applying the same structure to all of its operations. Is that how you read this? Valentine. Yes. And it's something that, from my perspective, was predictable, which is why the Phoenix program was re-released now, because what I predicted 25 years ago has happened. And you can only predict if you know the history. The CIA initially, and for decades, had four directorates under an executive management staff: administration, intelligence, operations, and science and technology. Executive management had staff for congressional liaison, legal issues, security, public relations, inspections, etc. Administration is just that: staff for finance, personnel, and support services like interrogators, translators, and construction companies. Science and technology is self-explanatory too, but with a typical CIA twist. Science for the CIA means better ways to kill and control people, like the MK-Ultra program. And now there's a fifth directorate, digital, that keystrokes and hacks foreign governments and corporations. The operations people overthrew foreign governments the old-fashioned way, through sabotage and subversion. The operations directorate is now the National Clandestine Service. The intelligence directorate, which is now called Analysis, studied political, economic, and social trends around the world so that executive management could mount better operations to control them. The operations directorate was divided into several branches. The counterintelligence, CI branch, detected foreign spies. Foreign intelligence, FI, staff liaison officers, worked with secret policemen and other officials in foreign nations. They collected positive intelligence by eavesdropping or by recruiting agents. The covert action branch engaged in deniable political action. The Special Operations Division, now the Special Activities Division, supplied paramilitary officers. There was also a political and psychological branch that specialized in all forms of propaganda. These branches and directorates were career paths for operations officers, operators, assigned to geographical divisions. An FI staff officer might spend his or her entire career in the Far East Asia division. The managers could move people around, but those things, generally speaking, were in place when the CIA began. The events that led to the formation of the current Counterterrorism Center began in 1967, when U.S. security services began to suspect that the Cubans and the Soviets were infiltrating the anti-war movement. Lyndon Johnson wanted to know the details, so his Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, formed the Interdepartmental Intelligence Unit, IDIU, within the Department of Justice. The IDIU's job was to coordinate the elements of the CIA, FBI, and military that were investigating dissenters. The White House wanted to control and provide political direction to these investigations. The Phoenix program was created simultaneously in 1967 and did the same thing in Vietnam. It brought together 25 agencies and aimed them at civilians in the insurgency. It's political warfare. It's secret. It's against the rules of war. It violated the Geneva Conventions. It's what Homeland Security does in the U.S., bringing agencies together and focusing them on civilians who look like terrorists. The goal of this kind of bureaucratic centralization is to improve intelligence collection and analysis so reaction forces can leap into the breach more quickly and effectively. In 1967, the CIA already had computer experts who were traveling around by jet. The world was getting smaller, and the CIA, which had all the cutting-edge technology, was way out in front. It hired Ivy Leaguers like Nelson Brigham to make the machine run smoothly. Brigham, as I've explained elsewhere, was the foreign intelligence staff officer who organized the Phoenix program based on principles Rensis Likert articulated in his book, New Patterns of Management. Brigham believed he could use reporting formats as a tool to shape the behavior of CIA officers in the field. In particular, he hoped to correct the grave problem of distortion and cover-up which a reporting system must address. Likert organized industries to be adaptable, and the CIA organized itself the same way. It was always reorganizing itself to adapt to new threats. And in 1967, while Brigham was forming Phoenix to neutralize the leaders of the insurgency in South Vietnam, James Angleton and the CIA's counterintelligence staff were creating the MH Chaos program in Langley, Virginia, to spy on members of the anti-war movement and turn as many of them as possible into double agents. Chaos was the code name for the special operations group within Angleton's counterintelligence staff. The CIA's current counterterrorism center, which was established in 1986, is a direct descendant of Chaos. Starting in 1967, White House political cadres, through the IDIU in the Justice Department, coordinated the CIA's Chaos program, the FBI's COINTELPRO program, and the military's domestic spying programs. When Nixon took office in January 1969, he immediately grasped the partisan political potential of the IDIU and these various domestic spying programs. The Nixon White House expanded Chaos and assigned its chief, Richard Ober, a deputy and a case officer. The Chaos staff occupied a vault in the basement at CIA headquarters in Virginia. It had a room where files were kept and where slides of suspects and potential recruits were viewed. A group of female secretaries managed the super-secret files. Chaos was super-secret because it was illegal for the CIA to engage in domestic operations. Assignment to it was considered a command performance. There was a communications system exclusively for Chaos cables and couriers to CIA stations overseas. The Chaos back channel could bypass the division chiefs and station chiefs and work directly with its unilateral assets in the country. Chaos traffic had the highest security classification, was restricted to only those officers involved in the operation, and was inaccessible to everyone but the CIA's top administrators. In October 1969, based on names provided by the FBI, the Chaos case officer began recruiting double agents from the Black Power and anti-war movements. I never learned his name, but the case officer only approached people with radical credentials. Radicals who passed polygraph and psychological assessment tests were recruited, trained in the clandestine arts, supplied with gadgetry and cash, given a cover, and sent overseas. The case officer called his 40 to 50 double agents dangles because their job was to act like normal radicals and hope that a gullible KGB agent would make an approach. Chaos dangles also spied and reported on their American colleagues. That's the illegal domestic part. A folder was created for each dissident. The folder contained the dissident's 201 personality file from the FBI and included everything from arrest records to report cards to surreptitious photos taken of the person with other radicals. Some 7,000 to 10,000 hard files were eventually assembled. In 1970, the Chaos Squad started entering its information on radicals onto IBM cards and compiling it in a database codenamed Hydra that ultimately contained the names of some 300,000 people. Hydra was developed domestically at the same time as the Phoenix Information System, PHMIS, in Vietnam, by the same people. Chaos included a mail intercept program codenamed HT-Lingual. I'm sure the anthrax scare after 9/11 was a CIA provocation designed to justify a mail intercept program similar to HT-Lingual. All of these things I'm talking about are happening today on a much grander scale within the Muslim American community. In 1971, the IDIU's Intelligence Evaluation Committee was managed by Robert Mardian, the Nixon administration's Assistant Attorney General in charge of internal security. The Chaos Squad was helping the Pentagon track Army deserters, as well as foreign nationals who were trying to coax soldiers to desert from U.S. military bases in Germany. Chaos dangles were sent to North Vietnam and Cuba, and one agent, possibly Timothy Leary, was launched against Eldridge Cleaver in Algeria. Another Chaos agent played a critical, though undisclosed, role at the May 1971 anti-war demonstrations in Washington. Even Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, monitored Chaos operations in regard to his secret peace negotiations with the North Vietnamese. By 1972, the Chaos Squad was working with Nixon's infamous plumbers. One Chaos agent may have been involved in the botched Watergate burglary that brought Nixon down. The mastermind of the burglary, Gordon Liddy, sat on Mardian's Intelligence Evaluation Committee and leveled requirements on CIA officer Richard Ober at Chaos. Liddy and his partner in crime, CIA officer E. Howard Hunt, are known to have directed Ober to spy on members of other government agencies. They also targeted Nixon's political enemies, including people like Daniel Ellsberg, who could in no way be considered terrorists. Which gives you an idea of the prominence of political cadres in these operations and how they used their power to conduct all manner of dirty tricks. Incredible power was concentrated in the Chaos Office. Ober worked with the National Commission on Civil Disorders, the Protean Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, and the Special Services Units, Red Squads, of America's major metropolitan police departments. The CIA has always recruited cops as contractors to organize and advise foreign police forces, and local police forces certainly helped the CIA amass its chaos files. As head of the counterintelligence staff, James Angleton was the CIA's official contact with all federal law enforcement agencies, including the Bureau of Narcotics. Chaos exemplifies how the White House, through the CIA's network of law enforcement contacts, could use the Homeland Security apparatus as a cover to conduct all manner of illegal domestic operations. It shows how the CIA could use participating Homeland Security agencies for its own insidious institutional purposes, and that individuals like Hunt and Liddy could exploit it for partisan political purposes. Hunt and Liddy's many misadventures resulted in the Watergate scandal, which cast a bright light on CIA's shenanigans and eventually led to the exposure of the Chaos Squad. William Colby was the CIA's executive director at the time. Colby had returned to the United States in 1971 to testify to Congress about Phoenix and had stayed on to take charge of the CIA's organizational affairs. After the arrest of the Watergate burglars, Colby worked with the Justice Department to have the IDIU abolished, and he made sure the Chaos case officer was reassigned but not disciplined. After he became director of Central Intelligence in September 1973, Colby personally minimized the damage by leaking some of the gory chaos details to Seymour Hersh. Colby also sacrificed his bitter rival James Angleton, who as chief of counterintelligence was held responsible for chaos and the mail intercept program. Colby's limited hangout and scapegoating of Angleton were part of a shell game, however, and the Chaos Squad continued to track radicals and respond to FBI and military requirements. Everything was the same as before, including the ultra-secure communication system and restricted filing system, except that now, and from then on, it was done under the aegis of counterterrorism. Colby started the ball rolling in July 1972 when he made Ober chief of the CIA's International Terrorism Group, ITG. Ober's new job was to set up and manage a central program on international terrorism and airplane hijackings. Building on the chaos files, the ITG started penetrating terrorist training camps in Algeria and Libya. It kept track of black militants with international connections, and its reports, like chaos reports, were sent to Kissinger at the National Security Council. Ober's appointment as chief of ITG coincided with the establishment of Nixon's Cabinet Committee to Combat Terrorism, the first U.S. government entity of its kind. After the official termination of chaos in March 1974, the ITG continued to occupy the same space in the CIA's basement. A new ITG chief was assigned and was assisted by the same female secretaries who kept updating the chaos files and computer tapes. As of 1975, no chaos files had been destroyed because the CIA could not adequately define a dissident. In 1977, veteran CIA officer Howard Bain became the third ITG chief. The notion of state-sponsored terrorism had emerged and was attributed to Libya and Iraq, both of which were said to have Soviet backing. As a result, Jimmy Carter's DCI, Stansfield Turner, directed Bain to organize the CIA against this new threat. According to Bain, counterterrorism was a hot potato, but a low priority because of ongoing congressional investigations into CIA abuses. Bain said Turner was hung up on the legal definition of terror. Turner insisted that CIA officers refer to counterinsurgency as low-intensity warfare, and in his effort to polish the CIA's image, Turner renamed the ITG the Office of Terrorism. Again, it was a shell game. Bain moved into the chaos/ITG space in Langley's basement. He described it as a windowless room as large as the ground floor of a house, divided into cubicles. There were 10 or 12 little old ladies running around in tennis shoes, he said. Operations were compartmentalized, and there was a vault mentality. Little was happening. The acting chief was the former ITG operations officer, and his job was following U.S. citizens overseas. An avid proponent of covert action, Bain had served as chief of the CIA's North Africa division and in other top operational posts. He was nearing retirement and approached his new assignment with the fervor of a man seeking to enshrine his legacy. He summoned everyone to a staff meeting and said, "Let's advertise ourselves to divisions." He set up a reference system to service each of the CIA's divisions, and each little old lady became an expert on a specific geographical area. Bain started meeting with his counterparts at State, Treasury, the FBI, the Pentagon, the White House, and the NSA. As the Office of Terrorism began to serve a visible function, he moved the office to a fourth-floor suite with windows. He was given an operations officer and recruited young men to replace the older women as his liaison officers to the divisions. He began working with Jim Glarum, the chief of the CIA's Special Operations Division, to beef up the paramilitary operational forces at his command. Meanwhile, the U.S. Army had created Delta Force to respond to the well-publicized terrorist incidents that occurred in the 1970s. Delta, and later the Navy SEAL Team 6, served as the CIA's vanguard in the nascent war on terror. Within the context of low-intensity warfare, the Office of Terrorism and its paramilitary units adopted a new lexicon in which anti-terrorism was the term for broad policy and counter-terrorism applied to specific immediate actions. Bain got a bigger budget and high-tech gadgets like silenced weapons and bugging equipment for use in hostage rescue operations. He acquired a fleet of black choppers and formed a crisis management training program team composed of a psychiatrist and a few case officers, which advised U.S. and foreign law enforcement officers on how to negotiate with terrorists. Bain set up a two-man intelligence unit at Delta headquarters at Fort Bragg, at which point Delta became a customer of CIA intelligence. Bain's Office of Terrorism sent daily reports profiling known terrorists and their activities to the Defense Intelligence Agency and the FBI. Very quietly, his unit began to coordinate actual counter-terror operations. "Say someone in Frankfurt had access to the Red Army," Bain explained. "Then Delta would send a team." Bain's Office of Terrorism handled each incident on a case-by-case basis, depending on whether it was defined as international terrorism, meaning the terrorists crossed borders or had foreign support, or domestic terrorism, if terrorists were operating within their own country. If the incident related to domestic terrorism, the Office of Terrorism could not get involved unless authorized through a presidential executive order called a finding. The need for a finding was a stumbling block. Bain cited the time Colombia's M19 terror group took 20 foreign diplomats, including the U.S. ambassador, hostage at a party at the Dominican embassy. Thinking the transnational nature of the incident qualified it as international terror, Bain, with the approval of the State Department's terrorism unit, launched a Delta operation in conjunction with the CIA's new SOD chief, Rudy Enders. Bain provided intelligence on the terrorists, while Enders provided Delta with the equipment it needed to stage a rescue operation. Meanwhile, the crisis management team assembled in Florida and prepared to jump into Colombia. But the operation came to a screeching halt when the CIA's Assistant Deputy Director of Operations, John Stein, revealed the operation to Turner's Deputy Director of Operations, John McMahon. As Bain recalled, McMahon asked him, "Are you trying to send us all to jail?" McMahon put the operation on hold, and Bain was forced to call his officers back to Langley, where they waited while the lawyers met with Carter's National Security Council staff. Only after the lawyers gave their approval did Carter issue the required finding. In another instance, Bain was not allowed to mount an operation to rescue Italy's Prime Minister, Aldo Moro. According to Bain, his superiors determined that Moro's captors were Italian nationals and thus were deemed to be operating domestically. Let me stress that all this was happening within the context of the Cold War. The Office of Terrorism was a feature of the broader low-intensity warfare strategy designed to thwart Soviet aggression in Third World countries like El Salvador. Not until 4 November 1979 and the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran did the context start to change. This seminal event marked the emergence of Islamic fundamentalists as America's new bête noire, and it allowed Ronald Reagan to crush Jimmy Carter in the 1980 presidential election. In the wake of the embassy takeover, Carter ordered Bain and the CIA's Office of Terrorism to work with Delta Force to rescue the 53 hostages. Bain told me the plan was based on a covert action plan to obtain current intelligence on the status of the hostages, including Tom Ahern, the CIA's station chief in Tehran. Bain needed this information to know where to direct what he called the black and gray propaganda necessary to disguise the CIA's actual intentions. There was also a need to quickly train Delta Force to operate in the Iranian desert. The needed intelligence was obtained, but the government's first major counterterror operation, the Desert One Rescue Mission, failed to get off the ground. Several aircraft malfunctioned, and one crashed on 25 April 1980, killing 8 soldiers. As with the Benghazi tragedy, Republican politicians jumped for joy at the chance to criticize Democrats. The hostage crisis dragged on for 6 months and enabled Reagan to characterize Jimmy Carter as weak, which means instant death for any American politician. There was other collateral damage as well. Reagan's flamboyant Director of Central Intelligence, William Casey, fired Bain and replaced him with William Buckley, a veteran CIA officer who had served several tours in Vietnam. From 1969 to 1971, under his patron Ted Shackley, Buckley had directed the CIA's National Counterterror Program in Vietnam. In April 1981, Casey and Buckley traveled together to Saudi Arabia to pave the way for the construction of an underground network of secret military bases that would be available to U.S. forces. If the remarks attributed to Osama bin Laden are true, the presence of those bases under Saudi soil was one of the reasons he staged the 1998 embassy bombings and the 9/11 terror attacks. The war on terror took its next great leap forward in October 1981 with the assassination of Egyptian President Sadat by his personal bodyguards, whom Buckley had trained. The assassination nullified the Camp David Accords and freed Israel to target PLO bases in Lebanon. In May 1982, Israeli assets in the fascist Christian Falange militia organized one of the greatest acts of terror of all time: the massacre of hundreds of Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. In August 1982, Buckley returned to CIA headquarters to coordinate anti-terrorism policy through the Domestic Terrorism Group. Meanwhile, Casey appointed veteran CIA officer David Whipple as the CIA's National Intelligence Officer, NIO, for counterterrorism. A veteran operations officer with extensive service in the Far East, Whipple had been serving as CIA station chief in Switzerland. Whipple told me that Casey's executive staff consisted of 16 NIOs. 8 handled geographical divisions, while the other 8 handled issues like narcotics, nuclear weapons, and in Whipple's case, terrorism. Under Casey's direction, every government agency established a counter-terror office as part of a secret apparatus. Whipple, as NIO, coordinated the CT offices and assisted the CIA's division chiefs, making sure their station chiefs were properly handling counter-terror issues in their area of operations. Whipple ran the Office of Domestic Terrorism, ODT, from 1982 until 1986. His staff included an operations chief, intelligence analysts, photo interpreters, and case officers. Because it had the authority to access any division's files and co-opt its penetration agents, the ODT was resisted by the divisions, especially the Near East Division, which was on the front lines of the War on Terror. As you can see, the evolution of offices and later centers that transcended and coordinated the CIA's divisions was well underway by 1982. Throughout this early stage of its evolution, the CIA's terrorism office retained the legal authority to conduct unilateral domestic operations for a specific period of time before being required to notify and involve the FBI. The guidelines are more honored in the breach than the observance, I'm sure. The ODT also maintained the super-secret communications system instituted during chaos that bypassed the CIA's normal chains of command. As part of this back-channel counter-terror network, Casey recruited Oliver North, a doe-eyed Marine Lieutenant Colonel assigned to the National Security Council, NSC. Whipple served as North's case officer in the monumental political misadventures North embarked upon. Cut from the same fascist cloth as his ideological forefathers, Hunt and Liddy, North formed a crisis management center along with Rex 84, a plan to suspend the Constitution in the event of a national crisis such as nuclear war, violent and widespread internal dissent, or national opposition to a U.S. military invasion abroad. North's plan called for the roundup and internment of large numbers of both domestic dissidents, some 26,000, and aliens, 3 to 4,000, in camps such as the one in Oakdale, Louisiana. Certain trusted members of Congress were witting, despite that august body's periodic protestations that the CIA operates as a rogue elephant, and Senator Daniel Inouye cut off all debate about North's plan to suspend the Constitution when the subject was raised during the televised Iran-Contra hearings in 1987. In April 1984, North created the Terrorist Incident Working Group, TIWG, specifically to rescue several American hostages held in Lebanon, including the aforementioned William Buckley, who had been kidnapped the month before. North became TIWG's chairman, and in October 1985, managed its first successful operation, the capture of the hijackers of the Achille Lauro. A few months earlier, after the June 1985 hijacking of TWA Flight 847, while it was flying from Athens to Beirut, George H.W. Bush had created the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. As the NSC's liaison to the task force, North drafted a secret annex for its report, which institutionalized and expanded his counterterrorist powers, making himself the NSC coordinator of all counterterrorist actions. North continued to acquire greater and greater powers, and on 20 January 1986, National Security Decision Directive 207 made him chief coordinator of Casey's secret counterterrorism.